You're listening to a Speech Therapy PD podcast. Earn 0.1 ASHA CEUs for this episode by completing the accompanying course online at speechtherapypd.com.
Welcome back. This is season two of the Gestalt Get Together. Let me tell you a little bit about this podcast, just in case you might be brand new watching during this recording. Maybe you're watching on the stream on YouTube, or perhaps on a streaming service and an audio recording, maybe like Spotify or Apple Music. No matter how you're joining, I'm glad you're here. The Gestalt Get Together is your podcast for discussing Gestalt language processing, the autistic neurotype, the importance of sensory and acoustic decision making in our work, and how our field is responding to this growing world of GLP discourse. My name is Corinne Smoos, MSCCCSLP. I love GLPs. I work with them every day. It's my whole caseload. And I've had massive success using ideas from proposed frameworks like NLA. And I also identify myself as lovingly skeptical because I want more information. I want more data and I want more evidence to support these ideas that I see make kids flourish, but I'd love to know more about why. And I hope that you want to know more about why too. Now, I basically live in the journals and you don't want to know how many tabs I have open at any given time because I want to be synthesizing exciting ideas from the worlds of language, music, psychology, and neuroscience, so that you can grow your knowledge and your confidence working with Gestalt language processors. This podcast recording is 1 hour and it's offered for 0.1 ASHA CEUs. I am looking forward to speaking with my guest this evening about some of her areas of passion. Of course, Gestalt language processing, but also AAC and this guiding lens of connection, connection, connection over compliance. That is a phrase and a positioning that a lot of therapists have been aligning themselves with, but we want to talk more about what that actually means, what it actually looks like, and where you might be missing some of your own choices that might be more rooted in compliance than connection. But it is much better coming from our guests than from me. And so I'd like to welcome Cassidy Kuchmat, MSCCCSLP. Cassidy, tell us about who you are as an SLP.
Hello, and thank you for having me. I am a speech therapist up in Pennsylvania. I own a private practice here. And like Corinne said, I am all about GLP. Love AAC, absolutely everything about it. Have really taught myself from the get-go about a lot of that stuff and really have switched my therapy methods and approaches and viewpoints over time to really prioritize this connection piece, but in a way that is meaningful and that still makes meaningful progress.
So I know part of your career trajectory, you were working in a private autism school as well as early intervention. I'd love to hear, because I think some speech therapists, they move setting to setting. Some people stay in a similar one throughout their career. I know for me, when I move between settings, it's like, whoa, what do I need to update? What do I maybe need to leave behind? So can you walk us through how your work has shifted from school to early intervention to now?
So when I first graduated from grad school, I got a job in, like Corinne said, a private special education school. Every child there had an autism diagnosis. A few of them had a dual diagnosis of something else, but every single child to qualify to be there needed to have an autism diagnosis. So I was a pretty fresh CF when I was there, and looking back, it kind of makes sense why they hired CFs. They, you know, had trouble keeping people for a long time there, especially speech therapists. But that placement, I was there for almost 2 full years, and it really taught me a lot looking back. I didn't necessarily notice it in the moment, but I was working with kids anywhere from 6, 7 years old up to 21 was the oldest age that I had. I was mostly with older kids, actually. So the bulk of my caseload there were kids 13 through 21 years old, which was very compliance based. And I kind of was doing what I thought I should be doing, and I didn't honestly see anything wrong with it. There was a point where it just didn't feel right necessarily, but I didn't really know what else to do. I didn't know what this looked like. And eventually I ended up leaving that placement and switched to early intervention. And I really thought I was kind of like leaving this whole AAC thing behind because I was then working with the birth to three population, which there was not really a lot of people doing AAC in the birth to three, but this gave me a really valuable insight into working with parents, working and doing that type of like parent coaching approach, and really gave me a different perspective on how integral parents are and kind of what the behind the scenes looks like. I think it's very difficult, even though I worked in the school during COVID and was doing some parent coaching through teletherapy. It's really difficult to understand like what is actually going on in parents' lives until you're in their home every single week. And so that really gave me a good shift in perspective there as well too. And then eventually I kind of missed working with kids that were a little bit older, so I started my own practice and slowly trickled out of early intervention. I still love early intervention, but my practice just kind of took over.
All right. And what I am is that doing as I'm putting questions in the chat, if you're here live, to get people reflecting on their own experience and what's going on for them in the schools with AAC. So now you're in private practice, and I would love to hear more about your current positioning when you think about just laying out a foundation of what does building connection look like with your clients. Just kind of lay the groundwork and then we'll get in nitty gritty.
I think from a bird's eye view, it means really doing a lot of active listening. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the child has to be talking. But the same way when you're talking with an adult and, you know, there's people that you feel like before you even, you know, are able to get your thoughts out, like they already have a response ready to go and they're not truly listening to you. I think it's the same for children. We really need to kind of like throw our agenda out the window when we're first meeting them, especially, and just really find out like kind of what gets them going, what gets them excited. And a lot of these kids that we work with are things that it's very unique. And it doesn't, you know, maybe reflect what we expect kids to get excited about. I found a lot, it's really helpful to build a connection with a child. And like, what does that look like? Is if you work with any children that have siblings, siblings do this so naturally. I had a little boy in my office the other day that has a little sister, and he just started spinning. And so she kind of looked at him and was like, okay, I guess this is what we're doing now, and just started spinning with him. And it was just like true, authentic joy. So really being able to throw out all the things that you feel like you need to know. As my grad student said when she was here in my office, you know, get out of your own way and just truly be present with that child.
Now, I'm seeing some participation from some of our live guests here for the live podcast and some of the challenges they're experiencing in the schools. We do have a lot of participants who work in the schools. And what they're seeing is that implementation with fidelity, with the strategies that we know can lead to great outcomes, making sure that students have access to their device, even when the SLP isn't present. Someone else shared just getting everyone on board to use it, that idea of buy-in, which you know, I've in the schools, that's a challenge. I know even in early intervention can give all the information in the world and all the potential benefits, but then buy-in, but also just is this even realistic? How do we make this work for a busy family? Generalization across the school day, teaching people how to use it. And the idea someone else shared, like people want understanding and buy into the idea of modeling without expectation. Because that can really go against a lot of like what school looks like and a lot of what other a lot of like other teaching practices can look like. Did any of those challenges stand out to you that I just listed?
I think kind of the common theme is just getting people on board. And that's really tricky whether you're working in a school or working with parents. And something I've come to learn, I feel like really come across this as being annoyed in all honesty, you know, like why aren't these parents doing this? Why isn't the teacher doing this? Why aren't these parents following through with these things? And in the same way that we are trying to meet these children where we're at, we really need to extend that same grace to other adults. As much as it might grind our gears internally sometimes, we need to, say what is preventing these adults from doing this. And a lot of the times, like, they want what's best for children, and they're just operating under systems that aren't necessarily built to support that very well. And so what I found is really just trying to build that relationship with the adult before I even do anything, of you have to do this. People don't really like being told what to do. And they already have a busy day. They have a lot of things that they're supposed to be doing and tracking and keeping count of. And so adding one extra thing in, especially if they're not seeing kind of like the fruits of that immediately, can be really tricky. So as much as possible, trying to, I used to sit at the end of the day in the classrooms and just chat with the teachers and chat with the staff while they were there. And I know that some people's caseloads are ridiculous, and that can be a little bit tricky, but as much as possible, trying to find those pockets of time when you can build a relationship with the staff, prioritize that first, so that you get more buy-in from them of, okay, I do want to try these things this person is talking about. And also just sharing like really small wins. I used to do a lot of my sessions in the classroom, so the staff was somewhat forced to see it, even if they weren't directly, they could hear me, right? I couldn't prevent them from hearing me. So, doing sessions in the classroom, showing staff ways that they can make this fun and not just this like task of, okay, we have to pull the device out and it's this one extra thing that we have to add into these tasks for us to do.
But I'm also thinking about, I think the small wins is a really good angle, because it helps people focus in. Even for us, right? When we're thinking about like the big picture or all the things that feel like losses, helping to turn our attention to the small wins. I also think about something that was effective when I was doing early intervention in classrooms was having the teacher or the para or the person working with the child come up with their own reason why it would make the day easier. Like, what thing or what skill would make so and so's day just a little bit easier? Like, think about what routine could be just a little bit easier. And then they're coming up with the idea. They're identifying their own need or their own gap, and then you can work together to fill that in, rather than coming in and being like, I need you to do this and this, and you're doing this wrong. It's that co-creating of how to fill the gap. Did it
Yeah,
always
I
work?
love that. I think that's a great idea.
It totally, like 8 out of 10 times, it was still just like, leave me alone, leave me alone. But
Right.
once in a while, it was like, wait, and then you're building the problem-solving skill. And I've been hearing from Amy Zubrinsky has been talking a lot about like reflexive questioning with GLPs. And it's a great thing we can use with parents and teachers too, of like, how are we thinking about these decisions? So let's stretch it out a little bit more to Gestalt processors. So when I say AAC and GLP, what are some of the first things that pop into your head? Not only for you, Cassidy, but if you're listening live, what pops into everyone's head when you say AAC, GLP?
I actually just did a training at the grad school that I was at, and one of the topics was AAC and GLP. And one of the first things I said in the beginning of this slide was, I want to preface this that people have very, very strong opinions. And at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter to some degree of following this very strict, rigid thing. There's a lot of good research, best practice principles that we can incorporate when it comes to AAC and GLP. And really, our goal with any kid is what's happening, what are we seeing, and let's kind of work with what this child is already showing us. So that's kind of my off the top of my head
Yeah.
thing about it.
And I think that relates to something that's probably going to come up later in our conversation, is about the kid in front of you and being really attuned to them rather than, gosh, I mean, how nice would it be if we had a checklist of this, then this, then this, then this, and then language, you're set. It's not that way, because AAC, we're being very selective about what system is the best match for this child. What is even the language profile? And with Gestalt language processors, there's so much detective. It's, you know. And so I know for me, when I think of AAC GLP, I think about taking individualization to a whole new level. Tell me about some of the decisions you make when you're programming for a Gestalt language processor.
I'm not going too crazy on like adding in tons of recordings and that kind of stuff. Normally, I'm doing a lot of like trial and error and in the moment stuff with programming to see, let me try this before I go super overboard on it and see if it even works. So I had one child that the mom was like, we've tried AAC, it's never worked in the past. And I said, just let me try it. And for this child, and particular, I had recorded some of the gestalts that she was using from shows and put them in places that made sense. There was a couple action ones that I put in the actions folder. There was some like description ones that we put in there. And the reasoning behind that was I just wanted to get some buy-in from her and the parents. I wanted the parents to see her use it so that they could say, okay, we, are seeing some success with this. And that child needed to feel connected to the device. She needed to know, oh, wait, this isn't just some tablet somebody's giving me to do work with. And so for that particular child, I put some of those very specific recordings in, and she really liked them. And now she uses them every once in a while. She's actually added some of her own in. She edits her device like she's an absolute witch. So we wouldn't have foreseen that in the beginning. For some kids, though, that's not super necessary. There's some kids that I've just modeled, maybe a phrase on there, actually sequencing the words together, and they're clearly attending to it. They're very interested in it. But I kind of was just figuring that out. Okay, let me try this and see what this looks like and see if they're interested in it, if they seem to not really care what I'm doing at all. Are they responding to it? Not necessarily touching it, but responding in some sort of way. And then if the answer is yes, like let's move forward with that. There's, as you know, there's not a lot of research out there on here's exactly how to do this. And I don't know that we'll ever have that, because I really think it's very individualized to what that specific child needs. So when it comes to programming, I'm not going super overboard, and I'm really only adding in some of those things if I feel like the client is benefiting from them, and if they show that as well too. For any kid, I'm going to add in personalization though. If they love Baby Shark, like we're going to add Baby Shark pictures on there. It really doesn't have to do if they're GLP or not.
Yeah, I think about I see clients, but I do coaching with families too. And I have a couple families where they have AAC, they've got their touch chat, they've got their lamp, and they're like, it's not working, but so and so said I need to do this, and I need to do this, not working. And it's kind of that like sitting back and figuring out, because they've programmed so many buttons that are supposed to work because it's supposed to help GLP. And it is a lot. It's all that front loading of, okay, well, we put in these kind of phrases and then these gestalts. And I pause because I'm like, it's not a gestalt until the child, it's a potential gestalt. But it really, I think you hit it where it's like, think about with other areas of a field, we do probes first. We probe to see if there's responsiveness. And I'd love to see more of that when it comes to AAC and GLP. That is similar to what I've been trying is like, let me put one or two with a video, one or two with audio, a couple where it's just the preloaded voice, maybe saying the name of a CoComelon character. What is going to catch the attention? Because we're trying to tap into perception. Like we're thinking like early stuff. What's going to get that kid's attention? What's going to potentially sustain attention, and what's going to add that value and that interest? There's this quote that I think about all the time. It's from actually Kaylin Partlow from Love on the Spectrum, and she's saying like, I'm going to butcher it, but like the best way to like help an autistic person learn something is by adding value to what they're already doing. So if we're adding something like a value and of interest, an icon that says the line from the show that they love, or maybe a video of you replicating the tableau that they create with their toys, and that like creates interest, then you're adding value to what they're already doing. So those are some of the ways I like to probe, and it sounds like you do something similar.
And I think also giving yourself permission, you know, speech therapists are busy. All of you guys that are working in the school are busy. It's okay to do things like in a session. I just had a session a few weeks ago, and the child's like really into Sesame Street, and she likes deep voices. She likes a lot of like animation and dramatic effect. And I'm like, you know what? And I just stepped in the room. I told her mom, I said, I'll be right back. And took the device and on the Cookie Monster button, I just recorded my voice. It took like 5 seconds saying Cookie Monster, like in that Cookie Monster voice, and brought it back out. And like you said, I was just like, hey, look what I just did, and showed her. And she lit up and was so excited about it. And I just did it right in the session.
Right. Yeah. Quick aside, that like that timbre of the voice I talk about in some of the materials that I put out, and especially in my course about music, is leveraging timbre of your voice. So what is that tone? What is the way that I mean, it really speaks to the underlying emotion. And what I talk about a lot in the timbre section is that timbre is one of the first acoustic things that's perceived by the brain and processed, because it signals safety versus danger. It signals the like the gender or the species who's producing a sound. It helps us know water versus crackling fire. It's one of those first things. And when you tap into, does this GLP love like a gruff, grumbly Cookie Monster timbre? Or do they love voices up here? A lot of my clients love nasal voices back here. I don't know what it is. But that is why I really enjoy like that individualized program on AAC with recording our voices, or just pulling the raw material, original material. Because that those timbre cues, if they tap right into safety or feeling more activated, the emotion underneath it, timbre is such an indicator for emotion. It's going to be way more motivating and interesting than just Cookie Monster. You know? So timbre is just an aside I wanted to put on there. But yeah, I think the programming during sessions, I love doing that for a couple reasons. One, I love seeing families build their skills and getting comfortable programming. And I will narrate my mistakes. I'll narrate my errors. Like, oh my gosh, I always hit that button by accident. So they can see, like, I'm figuring this out too. I'm still learning. But also the child gets to witness the programming. And I was just on a call today with one of my coaching clients, and she was trying to figure out how to do a visual scene display. She had a great idea for putting a map in there. And then her child takes his AAC device, and he just starts programming all his own buttons, because he's been able to watch that over time and witness people doing that programming. So I love doing it during sessions. I agree.
Yeah, me too.
So we're talking a little bit about AAC pulling into GLP and what you just talked about of like doing it in session, talking to the family, trying things out. You're speaking to some of that, the collaborative nature of what we can do with these clients. Also recognizing that people who work in other settings don't necessarily have that same option. So I'm always trying to balance it, because I know that our positioning from private practice, even if we've been in these other settings, can be quite different. And so I'm hoping that there's ways that any listeners can modify and pull what makes sense for them. But you've been putting out a lot of content on your Instagram page, and people seem to be responding to it really positively about the importance of connection with these kids, any kids, but especially kids with really sensitive nervous systems and neuroception needs that might be more sensitive. And the contrast of that to more compliance-based methods. Tell me more about how you see those elements coming together, connection, compliance, GLP, AAC in your clinic.
I've worked a lot on, and I think this is important for everybody when it comes to kind of this compliance versus connection thing, is reflecting back on yourself first and foremost. Having a grad student recently has really helped me. You know, I have to talk out loud about a lot of these things that I wasn't maybe reflecting on before, and having her talk out loud about these things. But trying to kind of figure out like what triggers you. Like some people get very triggered by a huge mess or get very triggered by a child not responding the very first time. And so I've really found in my own clinic for myself, really focusing first and foremost on checking in with myself and, you know, what do I know about this child that kind of misaligns with how I feel about myself and, you know, some things that I might not feel comfortable with and really asking myself, you know, is it something that, you know, is it more, is what I need more important versus what the child needs more important in this moment? And, you know, kind of questioning myself of, is it really that big of a deal when it comes to this compliance versus, you know, connection piece? And also just again with myself being able to check in, something I always like to ask myself, you know, GLP, AAC, compliance, whatever it is, am I truly with this child right now? You know, like truly with this child, or am I trying to get them to do something? Do I have this, even if we might not realize it, the more we start to ask ourselves this is, you know, am I really having this hidden agenda? And it doesn't mean we don't have goals and things that we're working on, but continually during sessions, asking myself, you know, check in. Am I with this child? Is this child with me? You know, I think can really help with all of that stuff overall.
Are you ready for me to dive in to the concept of therapeutic presence?
Go for it.
I am so excited. Now, notorious info dumper. So cut me off, jump in if you need to. Reading the content you put out and your posts, I kept thinking, oh my gosh, this sounds so much like therapeutic presence, which is pulled from humanistic psychology. And I pulled a couple of papers and I pulled out some quotes that reminded me so much of what you say and how you describe your work. And what you just said reminded me so much of a quote from, there's a paper called Therapeutic Presence, Neurophysiological Mechanisms Mediating Feeling Safe in Therapeutic Relationships. It's from 2014 and it's by Geller and Porges. And that last name I just said might remind you, and it's from polyvagal theory, which I want to learn everything about
I'm
polyvagal.
starting to become familiar with it.
Yes, it is. It's so well, it integrates so well with working with GLPs. And I am going to put the link in the chat for those of you joining live if you want to check out that paper. Okay, here is one of the quotes that just perfectly lines up, I think. Let me know if you disagree with what you said. Therapeutic presence involves therapists being fully in the moment on a multitude of levels, physically, emotionally, cognitively, and relationally. What you said about triggers then brought me to the next quote I pulled, which is the experience of therapeutic presence involves A, being in contact with one's integrated and healthy self, while, so it's like, wait a minute, it's actually about, sorry, I'm pausing the quote there. Wait, my work actually has a lot to do with how I feel about me, my integrated self. That might be a big conversation and a hard thing for a lot of people that, like, oh, I have to know me to show up for these kids. Let me continue the quote. While B, being open and receptive to what is poignant in the moment and immersed in it, and C, with a larger sense of spaciousness and expansion of awareness and perception. Thoughts?
I like how I didn't realize that the stuff I was doing was from the research. Because that was my first time hearing that as well, too.
That's why I love to pull from these other disciplines because speech therapists might not be like going into doctorate programs to study these things because I didn't learn about these things. And again, these are all psychological perspectives and stances that we can pull from and think about. It doesn't mean that they're like the be all end all truth, but there's these other disciplines that are thinking about what we're doing from a different perspective.
And I also think it's very easy to overlook that stuff. And as speech therapists, we're looking for this answer of, okay, well, I want this this very specific, tell me this one concrete thing to do. And we don't want to hear sometimes that the answer is to look at ourselves, you know, myself included. You know, we don't want to hear that that is the answer versus, you know, okay, well, tomorrow here is the magical solution to all of your AAC and GLP difficulties that you're facing.
I had to go through this on a pretty visceral level a couple months ago. I had, the SLP dream is to have your own clinic, right? That's top. And I did it. I lived the dream and I was, Cassidy, I was miserable. I was miserable. When I was treating in the clinic, it was this disconnect. It was absolutely this disconnect I was feeling because I wasn't my full integrated, healthy self. And I didn't feel connected to my clients. And so it was that strange feeling of like, and I know about therapeutic presence. I read about it all the time, but actually accepting that that was something I needed to change was really hard. And so I closed my clinic in March. I'm back on the road. And I read that line of like, with one's integrated and healthy self. And I had to make big changes to be able to be that, to show up for my clients. And also, like, it made my life, it made me feel better too. But it's those big questions of how am I actually showing up in this room? And how is that impacting this relational, interactional therapy? We're not giving kids a pill to swallow. Our interactional patterns are the active ingredient. And if we're not fully there, are we really being an active ingredient or not? All right. You ready for the next quote? I'm overquoting There's just so many good ones. Okay. This one, and I'd love for those of you listening live too, of course, if you hear anything that stands out to you, please put it in the chat. Once, and this is all still from Therapeutic Presence, the 2014 paper, and I posted the link in the chat for you guys to check out. The quote is, "When safety is communicated via expressed markers of social engagement, e.g., facial expressions, gestures, and prosodic vocalizations, defensiveness is downregulated. Cultivating presence and engaging in present-centered relationships can therefore facilitate effective therapy by having both client and therapist enter a physiological state that supports feelings of safety, positive therapeutic relationships, and optimal conditions for growth and change." Any thoughts?
I really like that safety aspect of it. And I think it's very easy to, again, overlook some of these really foundational things. You know, I hope and I think I know that all of the clients that come into my office feel that sense of safety, which allows them to make progress, versus even maybe more traditional compliance-based approach where this progress is kind of like expected. And when they're here, having, you know, that safety and those signs, like you had said, of safety, like the facial expression, some of those kinds of things. I really like to take the time and I've made goals around just shared enjoyment. And I take insurance. Like I'm not just, you know, someone that's saying, hey, I just take private pay and make goals for whatever, right? Like I take insurance, you know, I am subject to a system as well too. And that is therapeutic, creating some of these goals for that shared enjoyment, which, like you said, comes back to that sense of safety, which is integral, you know, to everything that we do. And it's also really important when, you know, even these kids that you might have a good relationship with, when something doesn't go according to plan, or, you know, I'm, you know, evaluating these kids' sense of safety every day that they walk into my office. So just because, you know, they were great 2 days ago doesn't mean that when they walk in today that we're going to be at that same place.
Yeah. Now, Nicole in the chat said something that I know you're going to be able to relate to, me too, and probably a lot of people, which is in schools, the pressure to meet goals and have data creates a lot of anxiety in sessions. So it's hard to stay present. And I hear about like the groups, trying to put groups together, 25 minutes, and you're trying to like hit all of these different things. And what if the kid is not in a place? What if they're not regulated in place to like receive that information? And so I think we can start potentially to talk about like what could it look like to cultivate safety with GLPs if they're using AAC in that more pressured environment. But also, I'd love to hear if anyone here listening live has ideas too. When you hear that, does anything come to mind about small ways to create that shared physiological state in a pressured environment?
I think as speech therapists, kind of collectively, and I know I might be generalizing a bit, is that sometimes we put pressure on ourselves that other people aren't putting pressure on because we feel like, well, we have to show this. And I found even when I was working in the schools that it's okay, especially in the beginning, to take a few sessions to really focus on developing this sense of safety. And often you're actually going to, see more productivity, so to speak, towards goals if you're able to take some time to really focus on this. And you can still write notes and still, note the child's engagement and, things like that as well too. And another thing I found, which I know this takes time in schools, I was in a school, is really looking at the goals and saying, maybe there's a way we can reword this that we're not putting this pressure on ourselves. The child has to request 8 out of 10 times or something in the session, because then it becomes about getting 10 times during the session. So I don't write goals like that anymore. And I think sometimes shifting the way that we're writing goals, I still have goals for kids of requesting items, but it might switch to they'll request 3 different items, during the session. And we're still doing it in a very connection-based way, but there's not this pressure of, okay, well, I have to hit this many trials to show this data percentage. It's still data. It's just, looked at in a little bit of a different way.
Rethinking goals was where my mind went first. Thinking about when I look at IEP goals of my clients, I see a lot of them are very much like top down of like word focused. We're speech pathologists. Of course we want words, but I think if we're setting, short-term goals around words, then we're always trying to get there as soon as possible without maybe paying enough attention to the fact that we can quantify pre-linguistic skills. We can quantify the heck out of them. It doesn't look as neat and tidy as like 4 out of 5 vocabulary words, but like there are so many skills on the way to expressive language, AAC use, that you can quantify, you can measure, and you can show progress. And there's this quote that I love. I don't know where it came from. And you guys know I love to cite my sources, but it is slow down to speed up. And whenever I feel like I'm stuck, especially when I was working with kids in a school setting, I wish I had been able to tell myself, like, slow down so then I can speed up. Because I was trying to speed up the whole time, but I wasn't doing the underlying things to help that child connect with what language feels like. Why is it important? Why do I want to engage with language? Now, prelinguistic skills, or like the underlying foundational skills, some of them you might think of as joint attention. And we know joint attention can and does look different in autism. But certain types of turn taking, not necessarily just like transactional turn taking, but like pushing, maybe pushing an object over to you. And things, I'm thinking even like smiling, like shared smiles, contingent imitation, reciprocal invitation. There's so many things that come before that top-down, like language, semantics, grammar, that you can quantify and measure. When it comes to AAC, I'm also thinking of like the communication matrix is a really good way to start to think about that. But there was a resource I used a lot when I was in early intervention, when we were trying to write goals and track with AAC devices for these really young kids, was looking at the competency areas. Is that something that you engage with, like the AAC competencies?
Yes, it's definitely something I like keep in the back of my head. I actually sometimes use it a little bit more for like older kids when I'm thinking about, like editing, turning the volume up, some of those more like operational competencies. But I also look at it as well from like a parent perspective too, of like, here's all the AAC things, that we could be working on.
Definitely. Yeah, and I'm trying to find right now there was, oh, I think it was the dynamic AAC goals grid that I used to use, but it really helped me kind of like break down and think about what are the underlying skills that are trackable instead of just like we'll choose 4 words throughout the span of the day. So I'm also going to throw those in the chat too, but thinking
And sometimes
about
with some of these kids, like when they're very early on and we're just focusing on the relationship, and I think there's a way to go about this in the schools too. I've made goals just for like initiating communication a certain amount of times, right? Like that is our goal, is that they're communicating with us. And so sometimes keeping a little bit more broad of they'll, initiate communication this many times during a session. And we're just using the AAC for input at this point. So we don't feel this pressure that we have to target these certain words. Like our goal is literally just that they will do something to communicate with us, whatever that something looks like.
yeah, I think it's I think back to how I was taught to write goals and having to really like shake my own, I mean, check in with my own physiological state about it, of like, this is what I should be doing. This is what is right. This is what is wrong. That's not from like an integrated, healthy self, right? I'm not being present with myself when I'm doing that, but like, how can I adapt goal writing to the kids that are actually in front of me? The way I was taught to write goals is not going to meaningfully track the progress for kids for whom progress looks pretty different. It might be more gradual, or it might be harder to spot for me, like an untrained eye, what those measures of progress are. So, thinking about it creatively from different perspectives, and I'm always excited to see when people are putting out content and information about creative goal writing, because sometimes it takes seeing someone write a goal really creatively to be like, oh my, I see how I can adapt this. I see how I can adapt this. I'm seeing someone shared that in the chat. Sometimes when I think I have to do something that, quote, proves I did enough or the right thing for the student, or the expectation of the supervisors, schools, insurance, I remind myself that we need naturalistic experiences to communicate. We need to learn about what they like, what they don't like. We need a relationship with our client. And there are ways to monitor for what they are doing that still meets the goal, but gives the client time to get comfortable, build routines, and learn from me. Crystal, that was beautifully written. Beautifully written.
And that's so true, because if we're so focused sometimes on getting the data, we put so much pressure on ourselves that if we just gave ourselves a little bit of leeway and permission, we'll get the data later on.
Yeah. And also just challenging your own ideas about what data looks like. There are so many ways that we can interpret the experience the person is having in front of us and like track, we can quantify things that I just keep going back to like how I learned to do it. And it was things like you could really count, you could really see. There are so many things with Gestalt language processors that you got to look like one or two layers deeper and be like, no, that's data. That's progress right there. So, and it kind of reminds me of like it brings me to when I think about like in a school, even in like early intervention settings, really across so many settings with kids is, and I mentioned this before, where we wish and we want that there was just that list of things to do. What do I do with GLPs? What do I do with AAC? A big, big question. And of course, I found some quotes from another paper. It's also about therapeutic presence, because I think you talk so much about this connection. And I'd love for therapists, and well, we have parents too who listen, who want to know how to bring these ideas into their homes. Thinking about how can we really tap, like, trying to find my own words here. What are the ways that we can think about, like, how our own choices come through to connect? Because I think a lot of people just throw out, like, connection over compliance. And then other people are like, okay, but how do I do that? What does that mean? I get it. It sounds really nice, but how do I shift what I do? there's this quote that I might plug into that a little bit. And what's interesting is they actually reference it. They reference Gestalt psychology, which if you haven't looked into Gestalt psychology, it's really interesting to see the overlaps. And there is a previous podcast episode where I look at the six Gestalt principles by Max Wertheimer, and I try and share the connections I see between Gestalt principles of how we perceive the world and Gestalt processing. So you should go listen to that. Also, use your code Gestalt33 if you want a free episode. But here's the quote, and this is from Congruence and Therapeutic Presence. It's by Greenberg and Geller all the way back in 2001. Quote, a genuine meeting of a client and therapist involves a willingness to understand the client and the prizing of a client's experience and Gestalt notions of presence and non-exploitiveness. So I'm going to pause there. Non-exploitiveness. This idea of like, this child experience is not for me. But if I'm thinking like, okay, I got the data because I got to prove that I'm a good therapist and I got to, then is that, are we almost, this might be an overreach and this might be uncomfortable. So feel free, anyone, to push back this idea. And I'm going to speak from my own experience here. That like, if I'm trying to mine a child's experience in front of me for me to feel better or for me to feel safe, then is it really for them or is it for me? So this idea of like exploitiveness of that interaction, and that was might be a huge overreach. But continue the quote. Therapists need to operate both with a genuine desire not to have power over their clients and with a belief in the therapeutic importance of accepting their client's experience as valid. Finally, they need to be fully present and in contact with their clients as well as themselves. So that idea of like a genuine desire not to have power over their clients. You brought up that idea of like thinking about your own triggers. Can you share about like, because one of the main ideas from this podcast that when we're planning it is noticing kind of pushing back on the subtle ways that you might be enacting compliance or asking for that. Can you think of any other situations, maybe even like beyond AAC, where that might come into play?
I think just in general, always asking ourselves, you know, and I think this is more of like a parenting quote, but like kind of picking your battles sometimes can be come in when we think about like these subtle ways of compliance of, you know, just because the child is doing that doesn't necessarily mean it's something they shouldn't be doing or that it's something that we really need to be like putting all of our effort in focusing on. But I also think these subtle ways come in too when we have this hidden agenda in the back of our mind. I don't think my grad student, my previous one, will mind me sharing this story, but there is a child that comes to my clinic and his family is absolutely wonderful. And he is one of those kids that, you know, he knows when you are have those very subtle ways of trying to, you know, get him to do something or to try to, you know, have some sort of level of control. And he was one of the first kids that I had kind of transitioned her to work with. And I just said, I don't want you to think about any of his goals. Like, I just want you to try to get him to interact with you. And that's it. Just like, do that. And I kind of knew I was throwing her into the wolves, and she was a great sport about it. And after the session, she said to me, that was so hard. He pretty much ignored her the whole time. And she is a great therapist, and she wasn't necessarily doing anything wrong. But what was happening is because it was a very new situation, you know, he was playing with these little character items, and she was trying to play with him. And, you know, kind of without realizing it, adding her own ideas in. And that's, I think, kind of how that subtleness can show up is, you know, we might not be trying to control the play as a child is doing, but with some of these kids, we are when we're adding things in. And that's kind of why the child was like, I'm not really a fan of this, but like, I'll stay near you. And like, I'm cool with you playing next to me, but that back and forth interaction isn't there because of those very subtle things, you know, of trying to control the play, even though that's not you know, what she was thinking of, you know, when she was going into it. She was like, I just want him to like me, you know, and get to know him and that kind of stuff. And by the end of her time with me, I mean, he was one of her favorite kids and would, you know, play with her the whole time, was chit-chatting with her back and forth. But I think we deal with that a lot with these kids when, you know, we need to really ask ourselves, like, whose idea is this? You know, am I imparting my ideas onto this child? And is that showing up to them as, you know, kind of losing that sense of trust, that sense of safety? Is it kind of turning into this compliance? Oh, well, like they keep showing me these ideas, the therapist. So, like, now I kind of don't feel the same interaction. And just again, it comes back to really evaluating each child individually and like when that is appropriate to do and when it makes sense to do. But I think that is one of the biggest ways, especially with people that are trying to do child-led therapy and aren't feeling successful with it, is sometimes we are still having these really small like pieces of control that we don't realize that we are enacting.
Especially if we have no idea that we're intruding upon a cognitive gestalt because it's not visible necessarily. There might be signs, but that's something where this past, I'd say, like year, I've been really pushing myself to step back. If the kid is ignoring me or there's rejection there, I'm like, I'm stepping on a cognitive gestalt right now, and it's my job to figure out what it is. And it might be that the arrangement of objects is extremely important. And I think I have the best idea in the world. Like, let me put a hat on this character. And that is breaking the cognitive gestalt of how things, they want things to be to feel safe, to feel good, and for the play to actually feel like play to them. And so, really thinking about zooming out, is what I'm trying to enter in on a cognitive gestalt that they want preserved in a certain way? Am I trying to like bring in, and it might feel so playful. It might feel so natural. Like, this is a great idea. I bet they're gonna love this. But to them, it's almost like tainting the original idea that they have, which can feel really unsafe. So it's kind of this pullback of, would it be therapeutic just to be with them while they follow through on creating this tableau or gestalt? Or can I get really creative about a way to gently stretch that type of play, add something that might feel safe to them? Which is a conversation for a whole other episode, because there's so many different cool play techniques to help stretch and pivot with that. But that's something I think about a lot of the time when I'm enacting and try, like, my own agenda is, I'm like, I have the best idea for how you can play. And it actually feels really, really unsafe to that kid.
And it really comes back to that question that I always ask myself of like, are we truly with each other, me and the child, versus, you know, am I trying to get them to do something? And I know a lot of people look at that as like, okay, well, then are you just doing nothing, right? And I think sometimes we have this very all or nothing mindset, but when we can put that at the focus, those kids are going to feel trust and safe with us, safety with us, and then they will be making progress and be doing more things, you know, because that foundation is really, really solid.
And it's a foundation of signaling back and forth. Again, this idea of top down versus bottom up, if we're just thinking about semantics, syntax, and that's what's driving us, are we really providing intervention or interactions that build that signaling back and forth? And that is the foundation. It absolutely is. Really, only from there can we get to authentic language on top. And so it looks like doing nothing, but what is really happening, if done well, is I'm sitting in a way that signals to that child that they're safe. Maybe I lean my head down, and that provides a visual signal that I'm interested. It's these subtle signals that communicate without words, so then eventually we can get to words. But we have to start somewhere that really like looks like work, if you know what you're looking for. I do want to share, so one of our participants, Taylor, thank you so much. There is a clarifying point. A lot was left out a lot when it comes to gestalt psychology versus gestalt therapy. And there's an important distinction between those two. So if you're looking into learning more about those, if you're interested in like the foundations of the psychology, like with I'd say like more like the perception, to look into the psychology part of it. But if you're interested in like the interactional patterns between humans and gestalt therapy, to look into that as your search term. So thank you, Taylor. I appreciate that. Now we're coming close to the end of this episode where we talked about, of course, AAC and GLPs, and we talked about connection and compliance. I held everybody hostage with therapeutic presence, but I want to make sure that we have a moment for any questions for those of you who are participating live. If there's anything that came up that you want to hear Cassie's ideas about, or you know, what's even pretty cool is if there's a question asked in the chat and then someone else participating has an idea. So we'll give a couple moments if anyone wants to put anything in. You know what? While we're doing that, Cassidy, can you tell our listeners about where they can find your work and if there's any ways to keep learning from you?
I am most active on my speech therapy Instagram, which is Speech with Cassidy. So you can find me on there. Feel free to DM me on there. That's where you'll have the most success with reaching me or, you know, getting to know a little bit more about my therapy style and practices and stuff as well too. I also have a website, speechwithcassidy.com. So same as the Instagram handle. I have a freebie library on there, and then an AAC ebook that I had created that just has a ton of handouts. It's actually great for school professionals. It has a ton of handouts on there as well too, that you can use to explain AAC to people so you can spend more time focusing on, you know, doing some of these things with the kids that you work with.
So you're saying it has like is are there printables and like shapes that fill
Yes,
out that
about 140 pages. Has intro to AAC. It's good for parents and professionals, but just a lot of good handouts just to explain kind of the basics of AAC.
Yeah, I see you've got AAC basics, choosing the right device and app, customizing AAC, how to model, and in parentheses without feeling awkward. And then troubleshooting and problem solving. This is great. I would have done anything to have this in the first few years of
That's why I made it.
it's right. It's great. It's fantastic. So I put those links in the chat live. And then we had a question of typically what percentage of the AAC content would be about gestalt? Are there references in your work to GLP or is it mostly just AAC as a whole?
There's like a small section that kind of talks about GLP. I'm not sure if that exactly, Amy, was what you were asking about, was in reference to that. But again, I think when it comes to AAC and GLP, sometimes we really overthink this a lot and we're looking for this like, if you have a GLP, here's exactly how you program this device, when really we can be just looking at good AAC practices and implementation. Modeling still matters. You know, maybe certain strategies like modeling a single word first doesn't matter as much necessarily, but and that's kind of alluded to. But for the most part, like the basics of AAC, setting up AAC devices, personalization, all the modeling things, aided language input can be applied to the child that you're working with in whatever way best fits their needs.
Great. I hope that answered Amy's question. And then, Kelsey, I see that you raised your hand if you want to throw your question in the chat. I think that'll be the last one that we have time for. So we've got the list too. Oh, accidental hand raise. No worries. Just a cool little gesture. Okay, so let's do some final remarks here. I do want to thank you again, Cassidy, for sharing your ideas. And trying to kind of bring all these things together. The first thing I want to say is if you or someone you know would like to get an ASHA CAU for free for an episode like this, you're driving in your car, you're listening to it anyway, do you want credit? You can use the code Gestalt33 to get a speech therapy PD course for free. Thank you all so much for joining this evening. I hope that you'll come back for another episode. We look forward to seeing you again on Speech Therapy PD. And once again, thank you, Cassidy.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, everybody. Good night.
Remember to visit speechtherapypd.com to earn 0.1 ASHA CEUs for this episode and to see our library of over 1,400 courses for all things SLP.